Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On Sunday, Native Americans and their allies erupted in cheers after hearing an unexpected announcement from the Army Corps of Engineers. The government agency denied the developers behind the Dakota Access Pipeline the permit required to continue construction beneath Lake Oahe on the Missouri River, pending an environmental impact statement. Energy Transfer and Sunoco Logistics said construction will continue without rerouting the pipeline. In a statement, the company said the White House's directive for further delay is just the latest in a series of overt and transparent political actions by an administration which has abandoned the rule of law in favor of currying favor with an extreme political constituency. The developers have filed a motion in federal court claiming they've already met the Army Corps' legal requirements. According to the Oil Patch Dispatch, the pending litigation claim is expected to be heard in the U.S. District Court in Washington, D.C. this Friday. Donald Trump supports the $3.8 billion project. A Trump spokesman told NBC News that he has sold between $15,000 and $50,000 in Energy Transfer Partners stock. Energy Transfer Partners CEO Kelsey Warren has given more than $100,000 to the Trump presidential campaign. So what's next? Well, it's freezing in Cannonball, North Dakota. The camp continues to grow, and Native Americans and their allies, many of them, say they're not leaving. Joining us from Cannonball, North Dakota, is Ben Alex Dupree. Ben Alex is an enrolled member of the Colville Confederated Tribes in eastern Washington State. He's been at Standing Rock for the past 4 months. He's co-director of Seventh Wave, a documentary about the annual tribal canoe journey off of the Pacific Northwest coast. Ben Alex was on our show earlier this year talking about his film, and he joins us from Cannonball, North Dakota. Hi, Ben Alex. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Nice to talk to you again.
Well, it's great to have you. You know, I've been following you over the past 4 months. This has been a very difficult journey for you, very inspiring. But it's brought up, obviously, so many emotions. What was your reaction when you heard the announcement from the Army Corps of Engineers on Sunday?
Well, I do have a live feed on my Facebook page. I went live on Facebook, and I was a little stunned. Honestly, the energy was really electric. People were screaming and hollering, and people were crying. And, you know, I was moved by the movement. Obviously, we're well connected there, and I think I was really surprised to hear that something legally went in favor of the water protectors. I think, always with cautious optimism, you know, I'm very cautious about any decisions that are made in this environment. But I think for a moment there, it did sink into us that we had made a small victory, and that victory was to have a decision go in our favor for once, when all the other decisions previously had not gone in favor of stopping the Dakota Access from drilling.
And a lot of people were upset with the Obama administration. The pressure was on him from a lot of politicians, a lot of environmental groups, because up to this point, he's really only said two things about Standing Rock. He was asked a question in Malaysia, and then he was also asked a question by a fairly new startup that most people have never heard of called Now This. And a lot of people were upset with this. So this really was unexpected. This did happen the weekend that veterans were arriving, more than 2,000 vets. The national media, I understand, have gone to Standing Rock in droves. Actually, CNN sent a reporter who was doing live shots from Standing Rock. So things really changed quickly, Ben Alex. In fact, you did a Facebook Live interview, I think it was on Friday or Saturday, saying that you were really confused about how you felt given all the attention now on Standing Rock.
That's right. That was actually a few hours before they had made their decision to not grant the easement. And I was having a moment to myself as I walked around the camp that I had been a part of for 4 months. And I saw very few faces that I recognized from all of the months that we've gathered and prayed and danced and sang and kind of grown together as a community. And I knew that at that point, it was a media circus, it was bittersweet because, you know, you work hard to get people to notice what's going on, but the international media as a movement is so overpowering that when it actually descends upon your scene, it's pretty interesting. it really feels surreal. Like it's almost like you're just an extra in somebody's grand movie. You know, it's almost like there wasn't any recognition whatsoever of the people that were there. I had an interesting moment while we were standing on the road, and CNN and a couple other news stations were there, standing there and trying to get the story of these veterans who decided they were going to march down a little ways on the road. And somebody was yelling out, "No, only veterans are allowed. You can't stand on this road." And one of the people they were telling that to was an older gentleman who I'd seen on almost all the actions that I'd attended, and he'd identified himself as a veteran every single time. And he had said, I fought for this country on foreign soil, and I'm here to stand up for my rights. And here was a gentleman who was standing almost as an extra in a movie, holding his coffee, being ignored, while other veterans who had just arrived were marching towards the bridge. And it was one of those moments when that actually, I went live after that, and I had a thought in my head. I said, is that what we're here for? Were we here to fight this long-term battle with all of our friends and relatives in order for it to get to the point where the international scene has to make their mark, has to make their identification on the scene? So it was confusing to me at that moment. I think I'm still a little overwhelmed by it. It's still very surreal that there are so many people here, and it's like, wow, it grew leaps and bounds. Now, is that a positive thing? I still question myself. I don't know yet. I think so, you know.
I watched a video yesterday of the storm. It's really cold right now. Can you describe just the weather conditions there and how people are coping?
It's been very, very brutal. A lot of people came during this time where the veterans came, and they weren't prepared. You know, a lot of people who showed up here weren't ready for negative 20-degree wind chills. They didn't have the proper coats or the gloves. They didn't have infrastructure set up before the initial blizzards came through. So it was a little desperate for a while. People were really trying to stay warm, gathering in common spaces, and they'd had groups of people who were going along into the tents and trying to find out if people were okay and if they were warm enough. So, you know, people came together as usual, you know, and Native people came together and did their best to try and make sure everybody was taken care of. But it I think it was a shock to a lot of people who got here. I don't think they were ready for negative 20-degree wind chills.
And also, is it true that the numbers are actually rising? More and more people are arriving despite the weather?
That is, I believe that's true. Well, they estimated that they had 2,000 veterans on their way, and the reality was that was 2,000 veterans that were organized by Wesley Clark Jr. And their organization that put that together. But there was actually 1,000 or two more, maybe more, of Native veterans who came out to be with their fellow veterans. So thousands upon thousands of people were here. At one point, the line, and you saw in one of my videos I put on my page, there was a line from the front gates of Oshetti Sacoan, and it went all the way up behind the hill, and it was invisible. You couldn't see the end of the line of cars coming in.
Ben Alex Dupree is an enrolled member of the Colville Confederated Tribes in eastern Washington State, and he has been at Standing Rock for the past 4 months. He's been on the front lines. He is close friends with someone who's been flying drones over the camp. You've probably seen that footage. So Ben Alex really has a long view of what's happened at the camp, the changes that he's seen. If you have any questions for Ben Alex about the mood at the camp, I mean, there's been elation, there's been frustration, as you can imagine, so many feelings. We'd love to hear from you. And then at 10:30, we'll be joined by Stephanie Sosi with Earth Justice to talk more about the legal questions. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Ben Alex, as someone who watches the videos, it's hard to get a sense of what's really happening on the ground. Can you talk a little bit about the decision-making process and the organizing and how that's changed over 4 months?
I'm sorry, the wind was whipping here a little bit.
Okay, you've been there for 4 months. Can you tell us just about the organizing parts of the camp, the decision-making, when everyone decides to go on the front lines? You know, who decides what tactics are most effective? Can you talk about that process and how that's changed over the 4 months that you've been there?
Well, you know, obviously this movement are several different camps. You know, the Sacred Stone Camp, which is, you know, LaDonna, and you know, you have you know, Rosebud and Osheti Chacon and Red Warrior Camp. These are, and you also have organizations that have been closely tied into this movement. You have the Indigenous Environmental Network. These are all Honor the Earth. You have all of these different organizations that have put their effort in, and also I don't want to leave out Indigenous People Powers Project, IP3. There are all these great organizations who have been working in this field and as camps and as nonprofits, as grassroots advocates, to find ways to make, you know, this change happen and stop the Dakota Access Pipeline. And it's varying degrees of success, and it's almost like I'm not even qualified to even explain how everything worked out over the past 4 months. I mean, obviously, certain camps were more involved in certain actions. Other organizations were more involved in the strategic operations of the camp. And you know, there's so many different layers that it would be really hard for me just to give you a brief overview, because it is fairly in depth, and that is that's the truth. If you have something more specific, you know.
Well, it's interesting to hear your perspective, because it's a longer view, talking about feeling conflicted about the camp growing, conflicted about CNN doing live shots and just wanting a veteran in the shot. And so I was just wondering, in terms of the organizing on the ground and how the decision-making is happening, because, I mean, it's amazing to watch. People go to an action, they get pepper sprayed, they get shot with rubber bullets, they get hit with cold water, and then people are up the next day doing it again. And a lot of people watching from the outside just wonder, how is this all happening?
I think it all just has to do with people having so much heart and belief in what they want to accomplish. You know, we have a friend, I won't use her name, but I'm sure people who are following this would know if you just Google. There was a young Native woman who had worked security who got her eye shot out by the police, by Morton County, and so she lost her eyesight. Mm-hmm. And you know, a few days after getting back, she was right there doing security once again.
Wow!
She's right there standing up and still continuing to represent herself in the camp as someone who's there to help and be a part of the movement. And so there's incredible heart and passion for what's going on here. And I think, you know, sometimes we don't even know how things happen. You know, they just happen in different waves. And like I said, different organizations make their mark in different ways. And so from my perspective, I don't know if I'm 100% qualified to specifically call out individual groups or people who have done the organizing for this. It's just a movement. It's definitely been a movement that's been preyed upon, and there's full belief that, you know, together we can make change in America, just like we were afforded in our First Amendment rights, you know. So there's a lot of passion and heart.
And Candy Mossett, in one of her live interviews, she's been on the show a few times with the Indigenous Environmental Network, she said, let's take a moment to really celebrate this victory. This is a huge deal. This really sets a precedent for tribal rights in the future. Is that how you see it?
I believe that I can look at it two different ways, and this is where I'm a little more objective about things than most people. I can see that it's a small victory that will set a precedent for decisions in the future. I think, yes, I do believe that that's right. I also see the other angle, and that is, if everybody believes that these corporations are just going to listen to the government and stop doing what they're doing, then they haven't looked at the history of these corporations and what they have actually been doing since then. They were told not to drill or put pipes in 20 miles from, you know, the easement spot, and they did that. They were told several things that they just didn't listen to. They believe that paying fines is easier than having to follow the protocol set forth by, you know, these laws and in the Army Corps of Engineers rule book. So, you know, there's skepticism there about whether or not they're gonna listen to the U.S. government and the Corps of Engineers' decision, or they're just going to continue to do what they're doing. So, yes, it is a small victory, and yes, it is still scary that they have the money and the power and the ability to continue just to do what they want. And those are the two opposing views that I kind of believe both of them. I think on the side that Candy Moffitt is on, I also do believe not only is it a good precedent for, you know, the future of these kind of decisions, but it also gave us something that we didn't previously have, and that was more hope that if we do gather and if we come together, that we are able to make change, and that's something that has kind of been a false hope in America for a while. You know, and so we are seeing that has boosted morale in a lot of ways. People are supporting the idea of making change through gathering, and Sandy Rock has become that, an international stage to gather and to gather your hope together. Now, legally on the other side, well, what Morton County Sheriff's Department has been accused of and now has a class action lawsuit against them is not following the rules and using these tactics and these weapons against American citizens and taxpayers. They are under fire for, you know, doing things that are, you know, illegal by the rule book. In their mind, it's, you know, they're following protocol and they're doing that for the safety of the community and of their people. So in that world, I think it becomes a racist thing a little bit more than it should be. You know, it's definitely very racist. You know, that Indian people are out here, you know, causing violence, and the white law enforcement officers are there to protect the people. And I think that that's a very dangerous lie that makes victims and it makes predators. Right now, you were saying drones. You know, our friend Drone Dean had an incident that got posted online. It had over 1 million views by now, and he was stalked by two masked people from North Dakota who claimed that they were going to, you know, beat everyone up, and so they blocked him in with the vans, and it was this big incident. And now, you know, those are the kind of incidents that are happening. They're becoming very prevalent in North Dakota, hate crimes towards Native people,
right?
Just in the town of Bismarck and Mandan, because they're so frustrated with this whole movement that now they're taking up their own arms and their own militia, and that's pretty scary. You know, that's not what we're not here for. That we're not here for violence. I don't understand where they get the idea that everybody's here in violence, because there are no weapons here. This is not a violent uprising.
I was going to ask you about that video, Ben Alex, your friend Dean, who flies the drones over the camp, who just has had incredible footage. He went live when he was in Bismarck at a hotel, and he was blocked in, and these two guys with masks approached him and started yelling things, "We're going to beat you up." They started yelling some really nasty things. And I've heard more stories about this. Linda Black Elk, who is working with the Standing Rock Medic and Healer Council, she went on Facebook to say that she has been receiving a lot of death threats. I interviewed another woman who's never been involved in any action before, and when she went to Bismarck after being hit with pepper spray to have a doctor's appointment, someone called her a prairie N-word. And when I was at Standing Rock, I heard from so many people that North Dakota is called the sort of the South of the North because the racism is so thick. And it sounds like, based on what people's personal experiences are, it's just getting worse when people leave the camp.
Right, right. It's definitely getting worse. It's definitely there's a lot of frustration in North Dakota, and you know, to be quite honest, I mean, this is a state that is economically deprived. This is a state that has harsh winters and super hot summers. It's hard living out here, and people out here they find themselves feeling that they're a lonely community that, you know, that sticks together, and those kind of set the tone for a belief that all of the water protectors are from out of state and here to keep them from economic stability and prosperity. And I can see that side of the story too. I mean, honestly, you know, this is a very remote place, and the economy is heavily driven by the oil industry. I mean, that's what the money that's coming out of here. And so you can see that really what I see is people thinking that Native people and the water protectors don't want them to have financial stability for their families, and that is a personal issue with them. And I don't think that they're seeing the side of the protector story, and that's, you know, health and economy and renewable energy and you know, a future for our children. They just don't see that side of the story, and so there's a big disconnect in that way, you know.
Ben Alex Dupree is an enrolled member of the Colville Confederated Tribes in Eastern Washington State. He's an artist and a filmmaker. He was on our show earlier this year talking about his film Seventh Wave, which is about the annual tribal canoe journey off of the Pacific Northwest coast. And he has been at Standing Rock for the past 4 months, so he has a longer view of what's happening there, the changes that he's seen, how the media at one point really didn't pay attention, and then all of a sudden they all showed up and CNN was doing live shots a couple of weeks ago from the camp. And if you have any questions for Ben Alex, we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts on the Army Corps of Engineers decision last Sunday saying it would not approve the easement required for construction of the pipeline to continue? We're talking about a section of the pipeline that's supposed to carry oil beneath Lake Owyhee, and that is the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe's main source of drinking water. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. There's a lot of questions out there. There's also some misinformation being spread. Some people are saying that the company is going forward anyway and they're still drilling. That is not true. So if you've heard anything and you're unsure about it, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Lisa in San Francisco. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you? I'm so happy that you have this, Rose. This is excellent. I was there in October, and I'd like to mention something that's really important. I think it's very important. One of the ways that all of us can definitely stop this company in their tracks, in their unlawful ways, is by looking at each of our retirement accounts and demanding from our unions and from our investment managers to divest from not only Energy Transfer Partners, but also to divest from the banks that are supporting this pipeline. And what I mean when I'm saying that is that I'm University of California employee, and I was looking at the University of California retirement plan, and I found that we have $3 million invested in Energy Transfer Partners, as well as $160 million invested in Citibank, and millions more in many of the banks that are funding, not only DAPL, but also the back-end pipeline as well, the entire pipeline. So we really need to show our commitment towards a just transition in our own daily lives by actually banking on a future for the planet and for our children by changing where our money goes.
Well, thank you for calling, Lisa. Over the past couple of months, there have been so many actions outside of Wells Fargo. I saw some photos, TD Bank in Vermont a couple of days ago. Ben Alex, I'm not sure if you were aware of this, but I wondered what you thought about it. A lot of people are closing their bank accounts at these big banks. And on December 1st, Wells Fargo requested a meeting with Standing Rock elders in response to all of these protests. John Campbell, head of government and community relations, sent a letter saying, as a follow-up to our previous discussion with the tribe, we would be pleased to meet with a select group of tribal elders to discuss their concerns related to Wells Fargo's investments in the Dakota Access Pipeline prior to January 1st, 2017. Ben Alex, what do you think of that?
Well, I think that's incredible. You know, and as this movement advances further, there are many heads and many fronts and many ways that change is made. So I appreciate the last caller there explaining, bringing this point up. You know, it's also this life of sustainability and change happens by using the simplest tools available to yourself, you know, like using glass jars that are recycled instead of continuing to buy or use plastic jars. We carry our own coffee coffee mugs around. You know, we don't waste the plastic and the paper. You know, sustainability is a lifestyle, and it's, you know, our country is moved by choices. Mm-hmm. And obviously, you know, economic, you know, using economic, you know, change is definitely a huge part of what's going on out here. And that is something that people can do in their own communities and their homes. I think we're starting to see the deconstruction of this faux American dream that led us into this crisis to begin with. And so, yes, definitely divesting is in and moving out of moving your money out of the economic turmoil is a huge part of that. And it also goes back to that basis that we talked about when we're upset about corporations like Walmart kind of coming into communities and destroying the local economy because it puts all the mom and pops out of business. This is the same kind of ideology that we need to start bringing back to our communities, buying local, supporting your local people and small businesses. It's kind of the basis of what America was built upon, ideally, and that's what we're trying to get back to as well.
Yep, and we're doing a show about the importance of shopping local in the next couple of weeks. Thank you again for calling. Today we are giving you an update, continuing our coverage from Standing Rock, where it is so cold, below zero. And even though it's freezing there, and people have, it takes in some cases 5 hours to drive just 10 miles, people are still showing up to the camp to express solidarity and join the movement. And we're joined today by Ben Alex Dupree. He has been at Standing Rock for the past 4 months, and he's giving us the long view, talking about the changes that he's seen, and also the reaction from the camp. They erupted in cheers on Sunday after hearing this unexpected announcement from the Army Corps of Engineers denying the developers behind the pipeline the permit required to continue construction beneath Lake Oahe on the Missouri River. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's toll-free, 866-798-8255. And you can post a comment or question at yourcallradio.org, or you may tweet us at yourcallradio. Coming up in a half an hour, it's the BBC's World Have Your Say at 11 o'clock. Stay tuned.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll be talking about the devastating ghost ship fire, which has killed 36 people. According to the East Bay Times, the recovery effort has been completed. Authorities just announced that tomorrow. The death total did not rise as crews combed through the final 10% of the building. And so tomorrow, we are going to talk with people who lost loved ones. We will also talk about what this means for the artist community. And we'll take your calls. Tomorrow we'll be talking about the ghost ship fire. Today we are talking about Standing Rock. We're getting the latest. You may have heard that on Sunday, the Army Corps of Engineers denied the developers behind the pipeline the permit to require to continue construction beneath Lake Oahe on the Missouri River. And if you'd like to join us, if you have any questions or comments, what are your thoughts about this Army Corps decision? It was highly unexpected. So many people said this is a major, major victory. What are your thoughts? There's a lot of misinformation being spread. So if you have any questions about something you've seen or heard online, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Today we're joined by Ben Alex Dupree. He's been at Standing Rock for 4 months. Ben Alex is an enrolled member of the Colville Confederated Tribes in eastern Washington State. He's co-director of Seventh Wave, a documentary about the annual tribal canoe journey off of the Pacific Northwest coast. If you just search Seventh Wave, you can find the show we did with Ben Alex earlier this year, and you can also see the trailer. And now I would like to welcome Stephanie Sosi to the show. Stephanie is an associate attorney at Earth Justice, one of the attorneys representing the Standing Rock Tribe against the Army Corps of Engineers. Stephanie is an enrolled member of the Navajo Nation. Hi, Stephanie. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you back. So what was your reaction when you got word of the Army Corps decision on Sunday?
Oh, it was great. We've been asking the Obama administration to step in and provide this for a while, so we were pretty excited and pretty surprised.
So the decision denies the developers the permit required to continue construction beneath Lake Oahe pending an environmental impact statement. What does that mean exactly?
Well, Dakota Access still needed an easement to drill under Lake Oahe. And what the decision does is, basically the Army Corps said that on the record that they've built, that they can't grant them that easement. And instead, the Army Corps needs to explore alternatives. And the best way to do that is through an environmental impact statement. So right now, it means that the Army Corps thinks that more information is needed until they can, before they can grant that easement.
And how long does this process usually take, and what is involved?
It's a pretty long process. So, you know, Dakota Access will be delayed for quite a bit. They need to go through a scoping process, which means that we're looking at exactly what the EIS is going to cover, and that includes a round of public participation. So, you know, the public can be involved. And then they come out with a draft environmental impact statement, which, again, requires a round of public participation. So once the draft is out, people can submit comments. Anybody in the public can submit comments on the draft EIS. And then after that, they have to gather all the comments. The Army Corps has to respond to all of the comments, so that can take time, depending on how many comments they receive, before they can compile the final EIS. So it can take several, you know, we expect this to take several months. Sometimes we encounter EISs that take years, depending on how big of a project it is.
And will it be possible for the Trump administration to cancel the environmental impact statement?
Well, the Army Corps made this decision after months of consultation with the tribe. They did a listening tour across the country on infrastructure projects. And the Army Corps made this decision, and it would be hard to overturn. And, you know, so there, I guess there's a question of, can the Trump administration do this? I guess, yes, they can try. We will challenge them every step of the way in court. We would argue that any decision that's immediate would be illegal under the law. Will they do it? I don't know. They could try, but we're going to be there every step of the way.
And we did invite the Army Corps to join us, but they didn't return our calls. Now, Energy Transfer and Sunoco Logistics have filed a motion in federal court claiming that they've already met the Army Corps' legal requirements. This is according to Oil Patch Dispatch. And the litigation claim is expected to be heard this Friday in the U.S. District Court in Washington, D.C. Can you tell us more about this motion that they filed? What are they saying exactly?
Sure. So on Monday, Dakota Access filed in the District Court of D.C., which is where we're involved, arguing that they've already received the easement back in July when they received other permits. Excuse me. You know, they put in their motion that they would like to argue it on Friday. It is highly unlikely that motion will be heard on Friday. You know, everybody, all the parties need a chance to respond. And so all the parties involved, including the Army Corps, including the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, and including the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe, who's also involved in that case.
And so at this point, legally, Energy Transfer cannot continue constructing the pipeline under Lake Oahe.
That's correct.
Okay, because there was some question about that. In statements, they've said, we're going to continue the pipeline. People at the camp have said that the drilling is happening, but others said, no, it's not. So you can confirm that legally the company cannot continue construction at this point.
That's correct. They do not Right now, they do not have the easement to drill under Lake Oahe.
Okay. And what could change under a Trump administration? The Trump administration says that it supports the construction. A Trump spokesman told NBC News that he sold between $15,000 and $50,000 in Energy Transfer Partners stock. And the CEO of Energy Transfer Partners, Kelsey Warren, has given more than $100,000 to the Trump presidential campaign.
Yes, well, we do expect to defend this position in the change administration, but right now we are focusing on defending against Dakota Access's motion that was filed yesterday.
All right. That is Stephanie Soce. She's an attorney with Earth Justice, one of the attorneys representing the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe against the Army Corps of Engineers. Ben Alex Dupree has been at Standing Rock for the past 4 months. And before we actually, if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And Ben Alex, Standing Rock Sioux Tribal Chair Dave Archambault has asked people to go home because of severe weather. He said, quote, "We deeply appreciate the people who have supported us, but when the storm passes, it's time to dismantle the camp and return to our homes," end quote. What are you hearing about that statement? And a lot of people have said they're not going anywhere.
Yes, that's correct. I've heard the same as well. I feel like there are many, many, many people at camp representing many different perspectives. I can't speak for all of them. I can only speak for myself, knowing that his request for people to leave was a shock to us. That was interesting. We didn't expect it. It was a bit out of left field. There are layers and layers of politics, and I'm not really quite sure that I'm qualified to identify exactly what branch of politics the decision was made from. Obviously, you know, well-being is a real concern out here because of the weather. The weather is very, very brutal. So I believe that that's genuine. I believe that the idea that they would hope that people don't come out here and get caught in this and die because they can't stay warm is a legitimate concern. I believe that the camp is split on the idea that it's time to go, because even though legally Dakota Access Pipeline is not allowed to drill under the river, we have seen in the past 4 months and beyond 4 months, but personally 4 months, that they have never once adhered to any of the laws and regulations that were put in front of them to begin with. I mean, for the most part, they've continued to do what they do with the help of Martin County Sheriff's Department and their militarized police force. They've continued to make, you know, human rights violations. They've continued to intimidate and harass and physically hurt water protectors who are peacefully trying to keep them from putting the pipeline in the ground. It comes with, you know, great skepticism when someone says that, well, the government is telling you not to do something and they're just going to agree. Because we've seen that there's a massive relationship between these oil companies and these energy programs and the federal government. I mean, they are, you know, very closely related. And this is, you know, almost to the point where they, you know, we understand that they believe that it's a homeland security issue, that these pipelines are, you know, a matter of national security, and that they have all kinds of ways to downplay water protectors. Beliefs about what this means. You know, they're a big machine. They're big machines, and a lot of the people out here just don't feel like they want to give into a machine yet.
What are your plans, Ben Alex? You've already been there for 4 months.
Well, you know, I can't really be for certain. You know, I haven't made that decision yet. I still need to get around and talk to more people and find out what people are saying. In my heart, I'm always the kind of traditional Native person that if I'm asked to leave, there's a part of me that really does want to respect that. You know, I'm not someone who grew up, you know, wanting to defy people, and tribes especially. You know, there's a very political thing happening out here. There's a lot of different layers. I will make my assessment of what's really going on, and I'll make my decision down the road here.
Hmm. Stephanie, what are your thoughts about what Ben Alex just said about Energy Transfer Partners, that this company has not adhered to laws? There's a lot of information going around about what the pipeline company has or has not done. From a legal perspective, how do you analyze the company thus far?
Well, it is clear that that Energy Transfer has no regard for Native peoples in the actions that they've taken. In September, when they bulldozed sites that we identified and filed in court the day prior, all the way to the water cannons being used against the protectors. So we're well aware that the company doesn't have maybe the highest regard. However, the drilling, in terms of the easement decision and drilling without the permissions to do so, we are looking into the penalties that they may face, and they could be pretty severe. Hmm. So I doubt that they would continue drilling. However, if they do, we would seek enforcement of pretty severe penalties.
And so if they continue drilling, that's the price they would pay as a penalty? How much is that per day?
Well, no, it's not just financial penalties. There's criminal sanctions as well.
Okay. We have a related question. Let's go to Kenji in Oakland. Hi, Kenji. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I missed the last few minutes, so I don't know if you talked about this specifically, but I was curious to hear something about how the great bulk of the pipeline that's already been built, how that permitting process worked and how well the company has or has not gone, complied with those permits and that process.
All right, thank you. You're right. The construction of the pipeline is almost complete. The only section that's really missing crosses the Missouri River. Stephanie, how has the bulk of the pipeline been constructed, with or without permits?
Well, the bulk of the pipeline goes through private land, and in portions where it goes underneath waters of the United States, they've been able to comply with what's called a nationwide permit process. There's no single pipeline permit. Instead, what the Army Corps views the permitting process to be is anytime it goes underwater, you just look at just that small crossing, and if it meets certain criteria in the nationwide permit process, then you just get a nationwide permit. You don't need verification from the Corps. In some areas, you need verification from the Corps when it impacts certain areas. In this case, for Lake Oahe, they needed an easement. So it's very spotty in terms of the permitting process, very streamlined. And the nationwide permits is something that we challenged in our original complaint because it is streamlined and because it allows for things like an almost 1,200-mile pipeline to go through without really any national scrutiny. So those nationwide permits really pose a problem for us in fighting this pipeline battle, because they're very streamlined permits and you don't necessarily need verification, and that's how most of the pipeline was completed.
Well, thank you for calling in, Kenji. We have a social media Facebook question from Laura. Ben Alex, Laura is wondering if the police presence is still there or have they left?
No, the police presence is continuous, and in fact, there was some drone footage just the other day that showed them constructing large army barracks, and there was a fleet of Humvees and a lot of their, their vehicles all kind of gathered in a large camp north, and there has been word that there's additional, militarized police. And maybe even DAPL private security. I'm not really sure, but I know that there are reports of many more people coming, on their end of things. Like I said, they've put so much money and energy into building this entire pipeline for this to be the last widget in their entire process. Obviously they're going to continue to have a presence here and to make sure that their interests are well watched, especially with a fluctuating camp of 10,000 plus, you know, people coming in and out. It is still a pretty hot zone, you know.
Mm. And Ben Alex, a lot of your friends have been pepper sprayed, maced, hit with rubber bullets, hit with very cold water and freezing temperatures. How are people dealing with the trauma? When I was there last month, a couple of trauma tents had gone up. Some people were coming to the camp specifically to help people deal with trauma. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? I mean, it's so cold right now, and I'm just wondering, how are people doing emotionally?
You know, it's variable. You know, obviously, there is something deeper, especially for the indigenous people here. There's deeper connections to trauma. Mm-hmm. Like we have almost a spiritually, genetically connected relationship with the idea of the government's trauma towards indigenous people. You know, this is something that we've been taught our entire lives, that the U.S. government and that the militarized police and the cavalry and all of these, you know, all these these massacres have occurred in within, you know, 2-3 generations of our lifetime. So it's very real to us when, you know, somebody's chasing you down a field with guns and sticks, and, you know, there's a bunch of Native people there and horses and buffalo and teepees. It really is a surreal kind of feeling that I'm still going to have to decompress and analyze over, you know, the rest of my life. I think that people are still in it, and right now there's always something new to focus your energy on. But in reality, you know, we have just gone through some heavy traumatic experiences that have to do with the historical trauma that we've endured as Native people. You know, that all the way down to the colonization of our camps, you know, when there was calls to action and you know, 2,000 people, 3,000 people showed up. A lot of them were non-Native, and we ended up finding ourselves being gentrified in our own camps. Mm. You know, it's like, you know, the same system that we were going out of our way to try to find, you know, this peaceful, prayerful, nonviolent direct action movement of indigenous people has in fact become a little bit of what we were fighting against, you know.
Mm.
And so there's a lot of things to analyze there and a lot of discussion down the road. I mean, when Dee Schneider from Twisted Sister shows up and makes a music video about him standing around teepee singing about how we're not going to take it or whatever, then you're like, wow, this has become a bit of a clown show. You know, it's like, it's not about them. It's not about what they do. It's about, you know, an indigenous uprising of prayerful people who want clean drinking water on their reservations, and they want the government to honor the treaty.
When I heard about that, so Dee Schneider from Twisted Sister, we're not going to take it. When I heard that he went to the camp, I thought, is that really that happened? And he made a video, and it's really corny. But yeah, I mean, so many musicians have gone out there. What about the veteran element of this, Ben Alex? A lot of people are talking about what happened over the weekend, where hundreds of veterans asked Native elders for forgiveness. Wes Clark Jr., who's the son of retired Army General Wesley Clark, said, quote, "We fought you. We took your land. We signed treaties that we broke. We stole minerals from your sacred hills. We blasted the faces of our presidents onto your sacred mountain. We didn't respect you. We polluted your earth. We've hurt you in so many ways, but we've come to say that we're sorry. We're at your service, and we beg for your forgiveness," end quote. What did you think about that? What are people saying about that?
Overall, I think it was generally accepted as a beautiful thing. You know, I think a lot of people really felt that. And you know, I don't want to be the pessimist and say that those kind of gestures aren't healthy for the mood of indigenous people. But, you know, that's not really who we would hope to hear from. We'd hope to hear from our president.
Mm.
We'd hope to hear from Obama. We'd love to hear that from the current military. We'd love to hear that from Morton County Sheriff's Department. We'd love to, you know, have a relationship with organizations that are currently, you know, in power. You know, those are the people that we're hopefully, you know, going to hear from. But I doubt it, you know. And so it's a great gesture. It's an honorable gesture. And I'm very honored that you know, the veterans would come and take the time to have that moment. And it made it really, it was sensational on social media, and maybe that's part of the movement. Maybe it's about just being sensational on social media to continue the storyline. But, you know, in the end, what we really want is just for Dakota Access Pipeline to not build their pipeline across the river, and to respect and honor the treaties of this that the U.S. government made with the indigenous people. So I think outside of that, you know, those gestures are just kind of like a nice day during a rainy week, you know.
And Ben Alex, I know you've got you're going to have to spend a lot of time thinking about this, but what else does this mean to you, or what has this meant to you beyond the pipeline?
It really brought me back to reality when I realized, you know, that there are really some big issues in this world that we have to address as a global community. Globally indigenous people, we're all indigenous to the globe. We have no other home. We don't live on the moon. We don't live on the sun. We live on the earth. And so as a global earth community, we really have to be conscious about understanding how we consume and destroy parts of our earth. So what has it done for me as an indigenous person? It's actually woken me up even further and brought me back to my roots and brought me back to the ideas that our ancestors gave to us. And that's about, you know, finding ways, actionable ways to cause positive change in this world and to take care of this earth for our children. So it's building that kind of a mentality. And it's not all going to be sensational. It's not all going to be water cannons and battles with corporations. It's as little as, you know, recycling properly and you know, not consuming too much gas by carpooling, you know, trying to find ways to make sustainable life through solar and wind energy. Like, there's so many things that we can be doing in our world to make our footprint lighter and to make our lives better. And it doesn't necessarily have to always be a big battle. It can just be something we do as a nation. Or, you know, like divesting in the banks. You know, that's a big motion that our nation can be taking. And those are very important. They're easy to do, and they're healthy, and they don't hurt anyone. And no one gets hurt, you know.
Yeah, and I want to mention, I just got an email from a listener about an article at EcoWatch called Oil Pipeline Shut Down After Spill Just 200 Miles from Standing Rock. Not getting much attention, but thank you for sending this article to us. Ben Alex Dupree is an enrolled member of the Colville Confederated Tribes in Eastern Washington State. He's been at Standing Rock for the past 4 months, and Stephanie Sosi is an associate attorney at Earth Justice, one of the attorneys representing the Standing Rock Tribe against the Army Corps of Engineers. She's an enrolled member of the Navajo Nation. Stephanie and Ben Alex, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Rose.
Thank you, and thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.